Welcome to session 1.4 of the Conference. It's Conference Studies 1. Presenting today are Hans-Ruhe Nabin, the Research Assistant in the Department of Economics at Anadolu Mayıs University in Turkey. He completed his doctorate in Istanbul. The presentation on the production of technology and science in Turkey analyzed Turkish conditions of production of science, technology, and innovation as a capitalist labor process. He has published articles on class, labor process, debates, and capitalist production of science. Besides technology and the changing labor process, his main fields of interest are class dynamics of social movements, self-organization, and the class as subject. Tara Martin is currently a part-time faculty member at Central New Mexico Community College in Albuquerque, where she teaches both sociology and history. She also teaches high school equivalency classes for Latin American immigrants in New Mexico. She received her doctorate in sociology in 2008 at the University of Manchester in England. Hugo Cheshire is studying political philosophy and comparative politics at Brock University in Ontario. He's researching theories of industrial citizenship in Western political thought. So the first presentation today will be Hans-Ruhe Nabin's paper on output factory occupation, first experience of workers' self-management in Turkey. Please.
Thank you. I have to read for my best English and exciting story, because I would not be so bad. I hope. This is a collective presentation. In fact, my colleague Özgür Mutlu, she couldn't come, so I will present on behalf of both of us. In his famous book, Coming of Age in Samoa, that was published in 1928, Margaret Mead changed the paradigm of anthropology. In spite of some of the controversies, one of the important themes of the book was concerning the adolescents with respect to the culture and conditions that the generation was living. For Margaret Mead, adolescence was not natural or universal in every culture. On the contrary, it was historical, that is changing different in different cultures and different generations. Actually, this perspective has been very familiar, in fact, central to Marxist class perspective. Each generation of working class members live, earn their lives, and struggle in specific conditions and specific social formations. As E.P. Thompson's Making of the English Working Class inspires, it's possible to say that adolescence and maturity of the working class are in fact just the states in making of this working class. The case of autonomous factory occupation and self-management is an interesting historical example to observe and analyze the making of the Turkish working class through this perspective. Altogut is the adolescence of the Turkish working class, which is the result of the wave of industrialization of the 1960s, an early but exceptional example in the story of this late industrialized country in Turkey. In May and June 1969, over 900 workers occupied the mine in Altogut, which is a small town in northern Turkey, an isolated town, in fact, and take control of the production for 34 days. The rhythm of this action could only be understood from the local newspapers' reports. As written in those reports, the workers had not been paid for months. In addition to the dangerous and bad working conditions, there were no occupational safety improvements. There were no mining safety engineers or professional monitoring the conditions of the pit for months. Finally, workers had decided on radical action and taken over the management of the facility. They had formed a general council of workers. Which elected workers' councils to control the production. They had organized the production and distribution of income in a participatory way. Within a month, the production had nearly doubled, so that they get their unpaid wages. The workers opened the so-called inefficient pits that the provincial administration had closed. The production in these pits was more than ever. Apocrypha gathered workers from the villages around. There were no job opportunities other than mines for those families, since the land wasn't available for the agriculture. As one of the workers declared in a local newspaper, all fertile lands were expropriated by the state for mining purposes. There was no option for the inhabitants of a quite amount of village. Either the family members would work in the mines or they would migrate to the large cities. The workers' families, women and children, supported the occupation for 34 days. One of the witnesses of the occupation that I had interviewed, there are a few occupants still alive today, was the son of a worker. As the reminiscence of the past, he told that he was very happy and excited during those occupation days, since he used to deliver his father's lunch every day like a ritual. He was affected by the atmosphere of solidarity in the workplace, as well as by the preparation of lunch at home for an activist father. Clearly, the gender role in family had not changed significantly. Occupation and termination of the workers lasted for 34 days. Lasted for 34 days to be ended by interruption of the state by using military force. 13 union members, especially the leaders, were fired. Some of them arrested, but the workers' resistance continued for months. Although it is the first known significant occupation that the workers managed to organize production and distribution in the history of the Turkish Republic, the first self-management practice of the working class in Turkey, an early experiment that is hardly heard in the main cities of Turkey. That was very important because Çorum and Alpagut was a very isolated town of Turkey. But during that time, during those times, the main cities of Turkey, Istanbul and Ankara, were very much, there were very, very social movements there. Social movements in cities like Istanbul, Ankara and Izmir were rising dramatically. Meanwhile, in Istanbul, there were university occupations by the student movements. It was a wave of, in fact, 6 days. Spreading waves of workers' strikes and occupations. An anti-imperialist storm of mass movements were raging against the U.S. Navy fleet coming to Istanbul. The workers used this word, the work de facto situation, they called the occupation and self-management as de facto situation. The de facto situation began to be used in the factory occupations in Istanbul by the workers. The word was used before, but not in that meaning. They used only by occupation. But the meaning of the word was still just the occupation of the factories, still the output occupation. So, how can we analyze this occupation? The specific conditions leading to the occupation must be grouped into parts, generally, of course. First, the general social conditions, and then as the second, local conditions. The general conditions can be grouped as maybe the important ones I should have to point out. The 1960s was the dawn of domination of industrial bourgeoisie in Turkey, especially May 27th, Kutada. 1960s, the Workers' Party of Turkey entered the parliament. That was a huge development for Turkish political movement, in fact. Concentration of the workers in relatively larger workshops as industrialization grew. And unionization. But the unionization has some problems, I would like to explain this. Since industrialization created proletarianization as well as it presupposed proletarianization, it became an industrial capital. Proletarianization increased. But for Turkey, we have to talk about proletarianization in two significantly different ways. First one, poorly managed state-owned factories on one side, and the other one, rapidly spreading private sector factories on the other side, especially in the 1960s, the second half of the 1960s. The first wave was long before 1960s, beginning after the World War II. Grant-seeking and partisanship in management and pool management were widely seen in this proletarization, they call in these enterprises, which are the public economic enterprises. In the second wave of proletarianization, working conditions and social rights were worse. Were very bad, in fact. The unionization of the first wave was represented by Turkish, that's Confederation of Turkish Trade Unions. Unionization of the second wave was represented by this Confederation of Revolutionary Workers Union was established by the end of the 1960s. The second wave formed the dynamic part of the workers' movement in the 1970s. Two examples characterize this fact in order to explain the background of Alpoglu, in fact, and the social political atmosphere of Turkey. Exactly a year after Alpoglu, in a town which is close to Alpoglu, Yeniçeritepe miners took over control of production, just exactly a few years after Alpoglu took over control of the production, and which is very close to Alpoglu, it's in a Kürün and northern part of Turkey. Their experience lasted longer and had much effects on the movement. The leaders of the movement were founders of mining union, affiliated to the DISK. All the workers were dismembered. This is the Revolutionary Workers Union. As social background of Alpoglu, we must consider the local conditions. The second one is the local process. These are the general conditions representing the general social political conditions which affects deeply the population. As local conditions, mining in Alpoglu had begun in 1940s, long before occupation. All the mine workers had always been gathered from the middle around, since there were no option for the inhabitants but to work in the mine. The weak wave of post-World War II industrialization had led out of Alpoglu workers to concentrate and unite as time passed. But these were between 1940s and 1960s. But in the 1960s, next and great wave of industrialization led to workers' movements struggling for their rights. Strikes and occupations began in Alpoglu also. Due to partisanship of the executives and run-seeking of the party workers, poor management of the mine and workers' response to that management, this workers' occupation and strikes, so before the occupation they are doing strikes, they are going on strikes, because poor management is very bad. And working conditions are very bad. Until 1998, this is the general description of mining in Turkey, but there is no need to that. As a conclusion, I draw up the conclusion is like this. I can open this conclusion if there's questions, but it's really the important part is, I think, Alpoglu shows the characteristics of proletarianization in the first strong wave of industrialization in Turkey, that's 1960s. Before that, there was industrialization, but mainly on the government or state-owned factories, industrialization growing. After 1960s, by the coup d'etat of May 27, in Turkey, the industrial bourgeoisie and the industrial capital took the hegemony. And this hegemony, in fact, very increased the growth of industrialization, and by that, proletarianization and urbanization. So this wave was very important, and this wave's results, as for example, Alpoglu was an early result of this wave, was very marked by the health conditions of this wave, this first wave and early wave. We can as a spontaneous action, the concentration of the workers, who the output began as a spontaneous action. There were no union effect, in fact, at the beginning, especially. But later, the union, Turkish, then the Turkish Workers' Confederation, after the revolution, began to control, but at the end of the unification, they began to control. The concentration of the workers who were no other means of production of mass space, who are in atmosphere of rising social movements of the 1960s on the other side. As a broader relations, we can think of the gender relations and the participation of women to the occupation and strike. Unfortunately, women participation to work is limited, nearly no participation in the output region. And so participation to occupation and the actions is in the role of a supporter. Due to the late industrialization, adolescence of public market generation might be completed only after 1970s in the before mentioned initial tech mine occupation. That's all. Thank you.
Any brief questions for Pedro? Next is Tara Martins. Cross currents of memory, myth, rank and file memory, and critics, winter discontent.
I'm just going to move there.
Yeah.
Nothing more exciting than watching somebody play another figure, huh? Whoa!
It's the norm. Every PowerPoint presentation I've been to in the past 2 years.
Really? Okay, yes, so I'm not the only one.
take, pull out your the stick drive and put it back in again. Use the peddlers.
Okay, I'm going to
actually,
maybe
best.
Can I have that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of them needs to go. Yeah.
If you press F5, I believe that the editing screen is much wider.
It's not much.
Hold on.
I'm just going to.
Okay. Just me. Woohoo! You know, I tell my students all the time that I never do PowerPoint because all my bad hate and hatred of computers comes out all at once. But it's necessary to tell you. Okay. Again, my name is Tara Martin, and I'm an American doing British history, and there's a break right there doing Canadian history. Today, I'm going to be talking about myth, rank and file memory, and Britain's winter of discontent. Historian Peter Burke defines myth as a story with symbolic meaning involving characters larger than life, whether they're heroes or the villains. So although we might think that myths belong to a bygone era, their presence can still be felt today. One such modern case of supposed heroics and villainy can be seen in Britain's Winter of Discontent. In 1978 and 1979, over 4 million British workers, from nurses to car workers to grave diggers, staged a series of strikes during the course of that winter against government-imposed wage limits. Such limits or income policies weren't uncommon in post-war Britain, but Labour Prime Minister James Callaghan's imposition of a 5% wage limit in 1978 proved particularly galling to trade unions. After 3 years of wage restraint, coupled with inflation depressing workers' wages, rank-and-file trade unionists were increasingly less likely to abide by yet another year of such a policy. The subsequent series of events were significant as more than a succession of 2,000 strikes exploded across Britain. To right-leaning newspaper editor Larry Lamb, these strikes were emblematic of the supposed sad state that Britain was in, and he came to coin these series of strikes the winter of discontent. It is at this moment in 1979 when three key political players emerged. One, trade unions, which you don't see here in the slide. Two, Labour Prime Minister James Callaghan, and three, our beloved Conservative leader Margaret Thatcher, assumed their respective roles as villains, dupes, and heroes in this myth. Political cartoons from 1979 began to illustrate the birth of this myth. In this first cartoon, you can see the ignorant Prime Minister Callaghan presenting the limit on raises, while the villainous worker, as you can see, cloth cap and shifty eyes, pulls away the percentage for yet another high wage increase. Or we can see Callaghan as a timid victim of union's insatiable appetite to destroy yet another wage policy. And finally, here comes our heroine. As Thatcher and her party followers are the only ones willing to confront the union thugs. The emergence of these caricatures became politically advantageous to Thatcher. During the general election of 1979, Thatcher used the winter of discontent to paint the Labour government as ineffective in the face of bullying from supposed militant trade unionists. So only 4 days after the call of the general election in 1979, Thatcher exhorted, "We have just had a devastating winter of industrial strife, perhaps the worst in living memory. We saw the sick refuse admission to hospital. We saw people unable to bury their dead, and we saw a government apparently hapless to do anything about it. I think we all know in our hearts it is time for a change." Here, Thatcher began the process of setting the stage. out of militant trade union chaos exploding across Britain, emerging the harrowing to save the country from the precipice of destruction. The strategy was successful, and Thatcher used the winter discontent to gain office on the mandate to flip the wings of the trade unions. She made good on her promise, and by the time she left office, Labour was bludgeoned onto the defensive with a combination of anti-union legislation, the defeat of the 1984 miners' strike, deindustrialization, and an overall decline of unionization across Britain. Nevertheless, the strategic use of memory did not stop once Thatcher walked into number 10 Downing Street. Rather, conservatives continued to employ the winter of discontent as a specter of decline and chaos throughout the 1980s and 1990s. On the campaign trail in 1983 and 1987, for example, Thatcher's most frequent request was for copies of the newspaper headlines from the winter of discontent, which he would then hold up as a warning of the consequences of voting Labour. While by 1997, the Labour Party was effective in shaking off this myth of the winter discontent, trade unions in Britain weren't so successful as doing so. At any whiff of a strike, right-wing newspapers in Britain mentioned the winter discontent to evoke the image of selfish and brutal unions to discount the strike. As recently as 2008, when public sector workers in Scotland were threatening to go out on strike, the right-leaning press recited a familiar script. We could be brought to a standstill later this month. Hard men in cheap hats, cheap suits warn us, and we're at imminent risk of another winter of discontent. Note the same script. Rubbish will rot uncollected, brandings will roll unattended in residential paragons, schools will go unclean, and yes, the dead will go unburied and unburned. This quote begs several questions. First of all, how has the winter of discontent continued to resonate so powerfully in British political culture to this day? Secondly, do over the 4 million workers who engaged in industrial action confirm this grim account of history? And finally, how is it politically significant in regards to working class politics in Britain today? In my presentation, I intend to address these questions. In particular, I'm going to examine the evolution, briefly examine the evolution of this myth of the winter of discontent. But today I'll be focusing on one key component of the script recited about the winter of discontent, the Great Digger Strike. However, unlike previous research, historical research into the winter of discontent, I will bring the previously ignored rank-and-file perspective of these strikes to the fore historical investigation. I don't want to go too much into my methodology and so forth, and my methodological underpinnings, but briefly, we have a minute of time, a plethora of thinkers, both sociologists and historians, have proven helpful in understanding collective or social memory of the series of events in 1978 and 1979. However, today I will focus only on two significant thinkers in my research, George Lipsitz and James Thomas. So first of all, to kind of conceptualize what I mean by myth, when I'm talking about the myth and the winner of discontent, Lipsitz is helpful because he states that myth can be pernicious or bad. He argues that myths, first of all, claim to describe a universal experience, meaning what is encapsulated in myth is supposed to be uniformly the same for everybody involved at that time period. Secondly, he asserts that myth can also be dangerous because it can make the status quo seem inevitable or natural. This is very clear, broad strokes. What does this have to do actually with the winner of discontent and the myth of the winner of discontent? Well, if we look to James Thomas, he argues that it was actually this which he calls representation, now we call myth, of the winter of discontent after 1979, which was crucial to the ideological success of Thatcherism. By providing the most potent popular image by which social democracy could so effectively be condemned as offering no alternative. If the winter of discontent was the defunct alternative to neoliberal the neoliberal conservatism of the 1980s, then there's no real choice for non-believers, just resignation. However, what we're going to look at today, Lipsitz is also quite not so grim. He states that the domination of the memory is actually never complete or absolute. He states that a strong current of counter-memory is always present. And he states that counter-memory looks to the past for hidden histories, excluded from dominant narratives, but unlike myths that seek to detach events and actions from the fabric of any larger history, counter-memory forces a revision of existing histories by supplying new perspectives about the past. And that's what I hope to do today in regards to my research in the Winner's Intent. This is based, this presentation is partly based on my PhD research that I conducted in the UK that ended in 2008, and I'm actually doing more so in 3 days when I return to the UK. But mainly, the focus was interviews with rank and file trade unionists, two Labour Party leaders, trade union, and cabinet ministers, and so forth. But the focus were rank and file workers that nobody actually really talked to. And then also, which I'm sure everybody else here does as well, archival research, and then finally looking at regional and national newspapers. And what I'll seek to put forward today is that rank and file perspectives, especially this one particular strike from the Grave Digger strike, provides a really, really strong current of this counter-memory that Lipsitz was talking about. But moreover, even though we start to see the emergence of counter-memory in regards to my research, the effect of this myth has had a very strong effect on working class politics in Britain today. So I will argue that the Winner's Discontent, the myth of this Winner's Discontent, has largely been informed and framed by high-ranking national conservative and Labour Party leaders, not just conservative leaders and politicians, but also Labour politicians. Therefore, once we begin to take into account rank-and-file perspectives, the myth of the Winner's Discontent slowly begins to erode. But also, I will show that despite the shallowness of this myth, its continued relevance has served to delegitimize working class politics and working class political identities in Britain today. So at the heart of this bleak memory, first of all, is a strike of 56 grave diggers and crematoria workers in Liverpool during the Winter of Discontent. This strike struck such an emotive chord with the British press and public, so much so that many of the facts of the strike became subsumed in this frenzy, leaving an indelible mark on the Winner's Discontent as a whole. Key misrepresentations that I hope to address today are one, that the strike of gravediggers in Liverpool was the result of a radical left-wing union, two, that the strikes were motiveless acts of cruelty, and three, the strikes were actually wild-caught, what we call in America wildcat strikes, provoked by unruly rank and file workers. These are but a few of the several misrepresentations that have distorted what actually occurred in those 10 days in late January and early February 1979. The first misrepresentation about the fact that these rank workers were belonging to a left-wing union called New Beach is actually quite false. These specific grave diggers in Liverpool actually belong to a very conservative, well, conservative relatively, union called the General and Municipal Workers Union. So first of all, they're under an umbrella of more of a conservative union that was still backing the labor government, but more labor rights. In the 1970s, harsh working conditions combined with low pay that bought less in a period of rampant inflation fed into a restlessness amongst rank and file workers within this union. As a result, by the late 1970s, the rank and file began to challenge the GMWU's top-down approach to its membership and insisted that the national union leadership address issues such as working conditions and pay. One such group of people were made up of Liverpool grave diggers and crematory workers, whose problems were with these issues were especially acute. Relying on picks and shovels, these particular grave diggers faced a laborious and oftentimes dangerous work environment. Especially digging in the northwest of England, where Liverpool is located, they have such nice sunny weather, The weather itself can make the conditions life-threatening. So one account, this is one of the grave diggers that went out on strike. He stated that when you dig in a grave and you're covered in muddy slime, I have lost count of times of the times when the earth has caved in while I've been digging. Every day of your life, you run the risk of being trapped and smothered. The dangers involved in the job were magnified by the grim realities associated with working with a decomposed body. So this is another grave digger that went out on strike. Some of the older graves we have to reopen contain coffins that are old and broken. One minute you're clearing the soil, the next minute your feet are going through wood and you find yourself staring at a decomposed body. Therefore, growing frustration with these conditions and low pay fuel the push for these workers to elect more assertive local trade union leadership. For these 56 grave diggers and crematorium workers, they found such strident leadership in a man named Ian Lowes, a 27-year-old local Liverpool, brought up in a strong tradition of working class trade union militancy. But these very local issues dovetailed with national issues, to return to this idea, this complete rejection of the national pay policy in Britain at the time. So the opportunity to change these conditions arose when public sector unions called a national day of action against the labor government's wage policy on January 24th, 1979. Nevertheless, and these are details about union strategy, but they have to do, they're crucial to the myth of the miners' discontent. Nevertheless, such massive action had to be carefully planned. Union strategists had to maintain a balance between having a national impact, showing the labor government that these income policies were unacceptable, but not bankrupting the unions by not having all the workers come out at once, because obviously that would bankrupt the unions. Therefore, the unions would allow key groups of workers to strike, while others of members of the union continued to work and pay for those actions of those people who are selectively pulled out on a strike. In order to employ the strategy, public sector unions involved had local branches, like those local branches, that local branch in Liverpool, propose strike action. And the membership would have to approve the action by a two-thirds majority. So at the local grassroots level, two-thirds of the people belonging to a branch would have to say yes to a certain form of proposed action. But secondly, if the proposed action was passed, it was then delivered to the GMWU's national executive, where the action would either be rejected or approved. So there couldn't just be one action at a local level without some kind of approval at the top. Set within these parameters, both at the national and local level, union organizers also wanted to bring out new groups of workers. Larry Witte, who operated at the national level as a researcher, and Ian Lowes, again, speaking from his experience at the local level, both agreed that in the past, garbage men, bin men, were often the only local authority workers brought out on the strike. However, in 1979, garbage men complained at a strike committee in Liverpool that they were sick and tired of being at the forefront of all disputes. Therefore, in exchange for a vote of action by these Liverpool grave diggers and crematorium workers to go out on strike, these garbage men or bin men agreed to close garbage dumps once the strike began. So then they have this more consolidated action. All that was left with it was for the national executive of the GMWU to approve the action. Witte confirms that the national leadership did approve the action because public sector unions were counting on the public support that emerged for workers in the early 1970s. So again, this is the at the national level. And he admits, we also gave some degree of authority to workers in Liverpool not to dig the graves. We didn't realize that it was a big mistake. We should have done it. So it is evident in the grave diggers' vote to strike and the GMWU's official sanction of the action that the grave digger strike was not simply acts of irresponsible left-wing trade unions of the winter of discontent, nor was it the result of a bloody-minded ranking file, as has been accepted knowledge amongst national conservative and Labour Party officials. Instead, The strike was part of a coordinated national campaign to resist wage restraint for national trade union. And it arose, hopefully, as you can see from the experience of these grave diggers, it arose out of an action to address specific grievances on the part of workers. These facts have become irrelevant, nevertheless, because once the workers came out on their first picket, there was no turning back from the wave of media and public outcry. So on February 1st, 1979, just a couple days after they engaged in industrial action, walked out, the Daily Mail decried about the Liverpool strike, "They won't even let us bury the dead." And then even more frightening was the Sun's headline on the same day, "Strike City Made Very Dead at Sea." We could go into really what happened, but let's talk about actually the effect on these workers, these striking workers. The media storm really stoked the fire of public condemnation that would befall these workers. Other than the national politicians actually calling for blood by stating in public that they wanted the publication of these workers' names and addresses for the public outcry to be wreaked upon these workers, local repudiation of these strikes often turned violent. So one grave digger described after they started going on strike, "We have been attacked by the press, the public, and in some cases our own families. Our kids have been attacked in school. We live in the fear of reprisals. Our homes have been vandalized and bricks thrown at our windows." The bitter public reaction to the strike triggered the government's move to immediately quell a politically damaging situation. On February 1st, 1979, Cabinet Minister Peter Shore personally intervened in the strike to try to convince the men to work. The GMW, the same union that gave these workers the go-ahead to have the strike, was also putting pressure on Lowe's, the local trade union representative, to call off the strike. As Lowe's states, they, the GMW leadership, gave us permission to strike. But obviously, when it got too hot for them, they said, "You got to go back to work." Eventually, though, the combination of this pressure proved successful, and the grave diggers voted on February 2nd to return to work based on humanitarian grounds. However, the return to work was to be conditional. The workers warned that if there was no settlement that included an improvement in wages and conditions, they would come out on strike in 4 weeks. But their demands were met, and they did not resume striking. Can I get 5 minutes or no? Okay. I'm getting tired. But although when this strike ended in 1979, the immediate resolution of the strike in Liverpool in early 1979 did nothing to ameliorate the profound and long-standing political fractures it actually had created. In particular, if we look at the Larry Witte versus Ian Lowe's and their subsequent political trajectories after the winter of discontent, we can see how deep these divisions cut. Such differences, first of all, are apparent in their evaluations of the strikes. Larry Witte, again working at the national level, regrets the decision to approve the Liverpool strike, which he believes was a serious mistake. When I interviewed him in 2006, he stated, "It," meaning the winter of discontent and the Great River strike, "came out of the press as if the whole country seemed to be out on strike. So it seemed like a prelude to revolution, and this is the end of society as we know it." But the grave diggers, it was a very emotional thing. Actually, this is the point where he teared up. But I didn't have a videotape, so it was just entirely wrong and you wouldn't anticipate it. But at the local level, we have Ian Lowe's, he is unrepentant. States that, "I also get asked a question, would you do it again knowing what you know now?" And I would have to say yes, because he had no choice, because of the circumstances surrounding the strike. If I had said at that committee meeting that the strike would cause a public backlash, so grave diggers shouldn't go out on strike, that would have gone down like a dead balloon. These starkly different assessments of the strikes would propel these two men down with opposing political trajectories. In Witte's case, all the energy he threw behind the national strike campaign was actually put later on into Labor's 1979 election campaign. Over the course of the 1980s, we came to be seen as part of an overall movement within the Labour Party against left-wing overtures, providing a Labour loyalist infrastructure in the unions. Moreover, his center-left politics of the 1970s became more center when Neil Kinnock, the leader of the Labour Party in the 1980s, appointed him General Secretary of the Labour Party in accordance with Kinnock's unspoken aim of reducing the power of the NEC and left within the Labour Party. And he is an essential architect, or key architect, of the new Labour paradigm as he placed key modernizers like Ian Nettleston in key positions in the Labour Party and pushed to create a more neoliberal trajectory of the Labour Party in Britain. I'm going to echo one more point and then over to my conclusion. His regret over the strikes, or his regret over the strikes, also resonates with other key Labour politicians' regrets over the strikes. However, they fail to mention any kind of connection between the GMW and the strike in Liverpool, or somehow that there's any kind of connection. Oftentimes, the majority of the blame for the strike is heaped upon rank and file trade unionists. So one key cabinet minister describes how nothing that happened in to me during my 3 years in the cabinet caused me more anguish than the sight of David Bassnett, who is the leader of the GMWU, who approved the strike, in tears at the thought of the way in which his members were behaving. He supposedly quoted Bassnett saying, "Who could have believed that Liverpool Parks and Cemeteries Branch would behave like this while members of his own national training team could?" So just to conclude, many of the negative aspects of the myth of the Twin Arts of Intent have loaded the blame on working class rank and file activists. However, myth and counter-memory of the Twin Arts of Intent show, we've been a bit more apparent if I cut down my presentation, how certain political identities have remained resilient in Britain while others have remained or become obsolete, i.e. working class political identities. So while somebody like Witty was able to be involved in the winter of discontent, he was able to refashion himself as a new Labourite in regards probably because of his authority in his class and resources that he could do that. Unfortunately, Ian Loath is involved at the local level, but he feels that there's actually no alternative politically, and that's actually what he gets quoted as saying, I'm pissed off, bitter, disillusioned, I don't want to be involved politically.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. I made a mistake, I was saying 3:45, we actually have until 3:15, so we'll have launch right into the next presentation. Trudeau's Cheshire's presentation, and so I'll have about 25 minutes left.
Smaller than that.
Presentations. Okay.
That's fine. Right. Well, initially they take 2 weeks, but that's the last, but I'm a pretty healthy tradition, so as soon as you get me, it's okay. And I also don't like the PowerPoint that much either, so I'm just going to talk for a while about Canadian auto workers. So, Canadian labor unions in general, including CAW and the rest of the world, have been under concerted attack for decades. Whether or not unions have been aware of these attacks or not, they've certainly felt the consequences and they've had to respond, which has been in a variety of ways. The political economists Andreas Bühler and Ingvar Lindberg have grouped these responses into two broad categories, and they named these defend and restore and modernize and adapt. The former seeks to return to a union heyday, golden age, such as it was, and reprise the Keynesian compromise by harnessing the power of the state again. The latter basically accepts the victory of neoliberalism, as a fait accompli, and attempts to salvage what it can through a compromise with capital, and both responses are inadequate. The reactionary camp basically refuses to accept the changed world economy, which has turned the clock back with wishful thinking, and legislates a return to a golden age of labor that basically required the return of a strong left-wing labor party. Unfortunately, that no longer exists in Canada. The concessionary camp accepts the emasculation of labor as inevitable, And so Wolf is his own demise. If he can compromise an agreement with a very hostile enemy, for whom any compromise of which will just be considered a basis of further compromise in the future. The Canadian Auto Workers Union originally separated from the parent United Auto Workers Union in the States in the early 1980s because they refused to accept the concessions that the UAW were making. Thus, they began in the Defend and Restore camp with a relatively militant position. However, the intervening years have seen a shift towards the Modernize and Adapt camp in the CAW, and the 2009 concessions are conclusive proof, I think, that this transition is now complete. These concessions have probably set Canadian collective bargaining back by between 15 and 20 years. The CAW gave up almost a third of their benefits and wages, and they allowed the government to set a very dangerous precedent for pro-capital state interference in private sector collective bargaining. The proximate causes for the concessions appear to be the worldwide recession and the decline of Big Three automaker fortunes, but the true reasons are political and not economic. Neoliberalism has infiltrated both government and public mindsets, and it has actually infiltrated the CAW itself. A reactionary union such as the CAW used to be would probably try and leverage political power into preserving labor rights, but the CAW has actually abandoned the New Democratic Party, which is the last federal Canadian party which even pretends at social democracy. Rather than find or found another left-wing party to represent them in the legislature, they instead advocated strategic voting, which means that they generally support the federal and provincial Liberal parties. This only makes sense within a paradigm of a coming to terms with a neoliberal agenda. The Liberals are not a left-wing party, and the Liberal government of Ontario has been of absolutely no help to the CAW in this latest crisis. The scene change in CAW attitudes derives from the internalization of neoliberal philosophies and a new belief in competition and profit. CAW now believes that it is in the union marketplace and its principal competitors are other unions. From neoliberalism as borrowing the axiom, people die. The leadership of the CAW have distanced themselves from and alienated other unions in Canada by high-profile raiding, for which behavior is being suspended and then expelled from the Canadian Labour Congress. The message from government and the media in Canada has been that workers must take responsibility for their individual futures and rely on neither unions nor the government, and this message has led those workers to internalize a culture of competition. The extent to which the modernize and adapt mentality has infiltrated the CAW rank and file can be seen in the overwhelming approval for concessions in the ratification votes for these agreements, which universally approached 90% during the 2009 round. Mentality has also permeated the public mindset and made it possible for a hostile democratic government to intervene in private sector bargaining with impunity. This has particularly dire consequences not just for the CAW but for Canadian labour in general. By endorsing a veto of patent-based bargaining, the government has significantly yet suddenly weakened union power. Bargaining still has a pattern of sorts, but the union no longer has the power to set it. Previously, a collective agreement with one firm in the sector would be used as the basis for agreements with firms in the same sector. Sometimes that would even apply to unorganized employees. When bargaining without this tacit agreement, however, any firm may demand greater concessions than were established by previous collective agreements, and if it wins them, it's certain that other firms will reopen their own collective agreements to try and match or beat them. Since the end of the post-war compromise, union positions everywhere have been greatly weakened by neoliberal labour market restructuring. The FDA and AFTA have greatly undermined the Canadian manufacturing and resource sectors, and the CAW is particularly vulnerable to this. It's a union on a power base with roots in the manufacturing economy. It's attempted to restructure itself as a large multi-sector mega-union, trying to expand horizontally rather than vertically, and this has been detrimental to sectoral bargaining, however, and the recent concessions, I think, are good evidence of this. So, the 2009 concessions really begin in May 2008. A large majority of CAW workers ratified new three-year deals, which froze wages for the life of the agreement, reduced vacation day, and made new hires wait an additional year for full wages. This, unfortunately, was not enough to save the Big Three. They were already in a lot of trouble. By the end of the year, it was obvious that only government intervention was going to save the Big Three automakers. The governments in the USA and Canada were not about to just hand out funds, no strings attached, so they demanded austerity measures. The provincial and federal governments demanded that restructuring plans come from the Big Three by December 5th before they considered any kind of assistance from public office. At the end of January 2009, Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors all demanded fresh concessions despite the three-year contracts they signed less than a year ago. The General Motors have been promised a $3 billion emergency loan if they can get $150 million of concessions from the CAW. Chrysler have reportedly promised $8.25 billion in repayable public loans if they brought the CAW deal by March 31st. And without government pressure, it seemed unlikely any automaker would have demanded this reopening of the existing collective agreement. So, under pressure from the government and from management, the CAW reached a tentative agreement with General Motors on March 9, 2009. The current three-year agreement was to be extended to four. It would introduce new wage freezes, new benefit cuts, and those would amount to $7.25 per worker hour. On the condition that the GM received the government assistance that it had promised, and on the condition that GM maintained 17% of its North American production in Canada, the union negotiators unanimously urged the workforce to ratify the deal, which they did 3 days later, with 87% in favor. However, these cuts did not go deep enough for the Conservative Federal Industry Minister, who was Tony Clement. He demanded deeper concessions as a condition for the much-needed $7.5 billion loan. This was effectively a state veto of a ratified agreement between a private sector firm and its union, and it was a state imposition into collective bargaining on behalf of capital. Now, Clement was basically exploiting a desperate situation in order to damage the union. On the same day that GM workers ratified the agreement, the Chrysler president, Tom Lasorda, rejected it as a basis for negotiations. This is very significant because he effectively ended a long standard of patent-based bargaining by doing this. Chrysler basically blackmailed the government. It's a strong word and one I'm very comfortable with. They basically threatened to close Shopping Canada completely and pull out all their operations in Canada unless they received $3 billion in government loans. There was an outstanding $1 billion tax dispute, which they demanded be settled in their favor, and they demanded that there be cuts in their labor costs, which amounted to $19 per worker hour. Tony Clement completely endorsed this. And he ominously remarked that Chrysler's survival was in grave danger unless it could reach an agreement with labor and the government, by which he meant A, massive labor concessions, and B, a successful merger with the European automaker Fiat. CAW President Ken Lorenzo pointed out, completely in vain, that labor expenses accounted for about 7% of production costs, and thus wouldn't really help the big three by itself. He pledged not to accept a lesser deal from either Chrysler or GM. Tony Clement called it bluff, deserved to withhold any taxpayer-funded aid unless the CAW made further concessions, and he threatened to recall loans that he had already made if such concessions had not been made by April 30th. And then the government intervened in a completely unprecedented fashion on April 21st and sent both sides back to the bargaining table. They firmly told the CAW that they were to make further concessions to Chrysler. The CAW was forced to agree on April 25th. They agreed to the demands of $19 per worker hour cut. The deal was ratified to 87% of the workforce again on April 27th, and the following week, Chrysler filed for bankruptcy protection in the United States. Same problem, bankruptcy was also hanging over General Motors. On the 11th of May, they followed Chrysler back to the bargaining table, and again, the government imposed a deadline, which was for the CAW to make appropriate concessions, May 16th. Although, once again, they were willing to wait longer if it meant the union would fall and they get what they wanted. Tentative agreement was reached on May 23rd, in which the CAW gave up even more than it had to Chrysler, with a total cost of $22 per hour. All that the union was able to salvage was the promise that the company would use any government loans it received to address the shortfall in the pension plan, said shortfall now totaling $7 billion. 2 days later, 86% of voting members ratified the new contract. GM Canada successfully obtained $10.5 billion in aid from the federal and Ontario governments and promised not to make any new cuts to operations. And this illustrates exactly what happens when patent bargaining is broken. Collective agreements just begin a race to the bottom. Ford also rejected the patent bargain. They sought further concessions, and they announced that they'd be heading to the bargaining table on September the 8th. Ford was at the disadvantage of being the only big three automaker not to enter bankruptcy protection or to take a government bailout yet, and they were not even willing to guarantee jobs to their current employees. Ford pushed for greater concessions. CAW struggled to obtain guarantees for job security for existing workers. You might have been hoping that the relative financial security of Ford compared to the Chrysler and GM would work in the union's favor, but it didn't. On October 31st, a new tentative agreement was reached in which most of the concessions made to GM and Chrysler were repeated. The CAW failed to save 1,500 jobs. The Canadian share of manufacturing that the CAW had vowed to save was cut, Wages and benefits were frozen, pensions were slashed. 2 days later, the agreement was again ratified, this time by 83% of the workforce. Effectively, the CAW gave everything and got nothing in return. CAW's problems are more political than economic, I think. The Conservative government had ignored pleas to help the organ sector since 2005, and the CAW had been backing their chief electoral rivals, the Liberal Party, even though that party had been of absolutely no assistance to them. Economics alone can't really explain how the government could offer about $9 billion in financial aid and refuse to offer an additional 5% just to allow working Canadians to keep their wages, their benefits, and their jobs, especially when you consider that savings amount to about 0.1% of the 2008 federal debt in Canada. And their motivation was entirely political and completely anti-union. 2009 concessions were the result of events set in motion decades ago and over which the CAW had little control. And the union has had to chart a course through very turbulent seas and fortunately has not always done so with the wisdom and foresight it could have employed. The neoliberal movement basically stopped the march in organized labor decades ago when the seeds of the current concessions were truly sown. By 2009, there was no realistic way to avoid them. Proximate cause was the government, which saw opportunity in the dark light of the big three and employed the BEX as national of public money to attack the CAW, but that's hardly surprising when you consider Labour politicians and Labour leaders have turned their backs on each other in Canada. Capital, on the other hand, has successfully co-opted government into the neoliberal movement and has enjoyed considerable success in turning left-wing parties in Canada into a away from their traditional Labour base. Neoliberal values have become so infused into our culture that Canadian unions, not least of which the CAW, are not only confused about how to deal with these assaults, but even about their own role. The CAW in particular has foregone the political theatre. Thanks to the permeation of neoliberalism through the public mind, it has broken with its former allies in the Canadian labour movement. Because of this, the 2009 concessions were inevitable. More will probably follow if the CAW does not fade into relevancy altogether, like so other labour movements over the centuries have done when they fail to adapt to their changing environment.
Questions, comments?
Yes, question for Tina. I'm actually on strike in 78, 79.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, sorry, That's
okay.
So I was very interested in your and very supportive of your interpretation of the events. What I'm going to ask about is the counter memory aspect of this. Because one of the things I think is very difficult for is to, even for people involved in strikes in that period, to have a positive spin on it to counter the factual interpretation. And one of the reasons for that is that it wasn't a very positive experience for anyone, and particularly because people felt they were fighting against the Labour government, which had betrayed them and had for several years at that point. And I wonder what you think about the idea that the real counter memory here is not really an interpretation on winter discontent, but actually a much earlier set of events, which is the strikes in 71, 72, 74, which were very successful, brought down the previous Conservative government, were a very positive series of strikes, quite political in some ways, but generally speaking were victorious. And that's in a sense what the myth of the winter discontent has been attempting to suppress, is the memory of 1972, in the mind of strike of 72 particularly. And so rather than talk about that, which is what nobody wants to talk about, let's talk about this event, which wasn't a positive experience for anyone, which can be turned around in that kind of way. So as the search for a kind of memory might be talking for a different set of things rather than the event we're actually talking about.
Yeah, I think that's actually an excellent point because in regards to the states, there's probably two aspects, because there's also a gender divide amongst the people that the ranking and file trade unionists that I interviewed in regards to what you're talking about, how they remember it. I was talking about white working class guy from Liverpool and so forth. And he and other tended to be rank and file trade unionists did look to the 1972 strike as something which was victorious and great. And it's funny because it's also that's why Thatcher was so bitter. She saw what happened in 72 and she said, no, that's not going to happen again. And so I think that's an important element that but it's interesting and it's actually something that I've written a paper on. But women that were involved in NUPE, which is the National Union of Public Employees, and they tended to be like service employees, local authority employees. But the majority of those women involved, many of them during the winter of discontent, actually saw it as a positive thing, not Thatcher getting elected, obviously, and anti-trade union legislation, but they saw it as a moment where this is the first time I went out on a picket. This is the first time I actually did something really significant, and many of those women were propelled up into the higher reaches of at least Nubia and eventually came Unison. So I think one in regards to the 1972, the 1970 strike with Heath and so forth, I think that's completely important. But two, that sometimes it's not so uniform also, that not everybody saw it as so the 1979 strike has so negative, because many women were saying this is a great point for me. But I think that's my excellent point, thank you.
Well, listening to all three of the presentations, one is, I heard read this book about the last one, the Naomi Klein, talking about the use of the crisis, and obviously you can think of a more contemporary crisis in this decade, but even going back to the 1960s, you had a period of, in some of the work I was talking about in the 60s, they used this trope of crisis. There's a crisis, the government has to come in, and really, the part of the narrative is that labor is uncontrolled. It needs some type of regulation. There's a need for that. So I wonder if the panelists want to comment on this use of a particular crisis. I think clearly that our president and the present government in Ottawa are taking advantage of this, but you can see it happening in Washington and elsewhere.
Just in regards to crisis, there's been a Colin Hay wrote an article on how whether or not, you know, for example, me presenting kind of maybe discrepancies, factual discrepancies, no matter what, but how using the trope of crisis was so political, was so politically advantageous to Thatcher. So no matter what really happened, it was a chance to bludgeon the trade union. So at least that point, I think that is a really important part, at least in my research.
Yeah, I definitely think so. The thing I noticed in my research as well, when I was going through newspapers and so on, looking for the data on this, was that there's a very anti-union bias in India, so much the government exploits, basically. If you read popular newspapers in Canada, you get the idea that Canadian auto workers get paid $100 an hour, and take 6 months of a year of vacation, and get pensions that get collected at the age of 40, and so on. None of this is true, but this is what everyone thinks. Greedy unions taking all this stuff. It's up to the government to break those greedy unions, and they're more than happy to oblige. Maybe not as part of a conservative neoliberal attack, maybe just taking advantage of the public anti-union sentiment to exploit that for electoral gains. I'm not sure, but nevertheless, they go hand in hand with the public perception and the government attacks.
I've got a different sort of, but maybe it's piggybacking on that. You know, I would probably go into cardiac arrest if Maggie Thatcher or Stephen Harper, that was said a good word for unions and working people in general. But the problem in your two papers seems to be that then your leaders also behave complicitly in this idea to rein in this unruly batch of workers. And so that narrative, and myth is a good word for it, right? You know, now becomes, oh, in this new world of ours, a globalized economy, you know, we all have to pitch in and you know, concessionary bargaining and stuff. So I guess the question of that is, how do we, it's a million-dollar question, right? How do we, workers or whatever, fashion a new narrative that you know, starts to get working-class people, grassroots people, building things? Because CAW is now asking workers to bite the bullet, labor politicians, God help us, the Democratic Party in my own U.S. is of no use. And so where do we build the new narratives, maybe out of something like general strikes or factory occupations, which we don't have enough of in North America, in my opinion?
I think that going the voice of the legislature was a big mistake. I think that's what's really kept American unions back, is not having a voice of their own in Congress. But certainly in Canada, in one sense, the New Democratic Party, which is a party for labor unions, and those who really just drifted towards the center and after elections. I don't know if that's an endemic fault of electoral politics, that any party eventually will just kind of drift to a position where they're looking for votes rather than pushing ideology, if that's necessarily true. But in any case, I think it makes labor movements very weak when they have no voice in government. I think that really one place you could probably start is trying to get another electoral party going. In Canada, probably the electoral reforms, because it's very difficult right now with the present system to get a new party in. I know that Germany has founded a new party of the left, which is called the Party of the Left, which has had some success in the electoral system. That might be a good way to start. I'm not sure.
Oh, just to address I'm sorry, I don't want to be at least to reverse, because I kind of like, I think it's a very common, actually I don't know the situation in Turkey, but I'm an American and that's kind of where I came with this conflict. I saw British unions as much more strident and way better than ours, and I'm from a family of staunch Democrats, and I was always wondering why aren't our unions as strong as British unions and so forth, and now I see that they're actually unfortunately not. But I think that million-dollar question is one that definitely I think about a lot. And what I see from political parties, both the Democratic Party and the Labor Party, although I've met a lot of really good grassroots Labor Party people, and even some of these ministers who are peers in the House of Lords, make a lot of money now, they're nice people. But I think it's, unfortunately, what I feel is like it's systemic in political parties where people who are grassroots are marginalized no matter what is in the structure of a I don't know, national politics, because the people at the local level are, you know, they look to serve who they're working for. Many of these ex-union people, these women, these men, they're trying to serve the community. And at the national level, well, I don't, they're always going to try to make concessions. I just don't think that there's really, right now, I guess it's almost pretty bleak, but at least in my opinion, both from the British perspective and the American perspective.
To explain in English because of public English, but the 1960s was a development for Turkey. It was an industrialization period, industrial capital gained a hegemony and a great organization, the proletarianization began, and the strikes began. Of course, the effect of the all the workers, all the workers in the world because of the crisis of the 68 movements and others affected Turkey in a way. But between post-World War II and the 1960s, the privatization and industrialization was greatly dependent on the public sector. There was also private sector, but the public sector was dominant in, for example, raw material production. For beginning to produce steel production for newly developing private sector, which are the holdings and the big monopolies now, Sabancı and Koç. They are not monopolies, they are, for example, for Koç, the auto factory, the iron and steel factory. It was a public economic enterprise. Gave the raw materials with a very low price. It was subvention in a kind of way for the monopolies to grow. This was between 1960s and 1980s. This was a very hegemonic process for the private industry and industrialization of these sectors especially. And by this industrialization, the unions which organized in the private sector began to be very revolutionary, very active in unionization. Because these workers were already very working in a very bad conditions, no social security, they were very fragmented, but beginning to gather in a big factories first time in the Turkish movement's history. And political movements began to rise, especially after 1970s, after a coup d'etat which was not complete, in fact, 1970. It's known as March 12th coup d'etat in Turkey. Cannot complete its goals, in fact. 1980 coup d'etat completed its goals. After the 70s, the private sectors, unionization and private sectors, tries began to grow. But the industrialization also began to grow. In spite of the rising wages because of the union and strikes. But this, I think this was an age of, how can I say, conventional unionizing. The big factories gathering together, they were on strike, they were going on occupation. The first occupation began in 1960s, after the half of the 1966 strikes, etc. But after 1970s, the motive or the pace of the movement began to rapidly increase. And at the end of the 1970s, industrialization, growing debt exchange problem, because all private industry was working or was producing to the inner markets, internal markets, especially the internal markets. They were gaining big profits in spite of rising prices. But they were, of course, exporting the raw materials from outside, from world markets, raw materials, machines, and etc. This was something like a global import substitution. The economic policy that was in fact, it was an inner accumulation, inner capital accumulation, in particular, not an import substitution, but inner capital accumulation. At the end of the 1970s, the debt crisis began to rise for the industrialists, and the workers' movements began to rise dramatically. So there needs to be a strong and aggressive effort in order to decompose the working class movement and to pave the way for growing bourgeoisie, from industrial bourgeoisie. They need to go out, they need to import their productions, and they need to get some debts and exchange current currency, for example, dollars. They need to get the debts. 1980 Kutepe was this Kutepe that aimed at this goal after. And I think there is something pretty. This was a general effect of crisis in Turkey, the crisis of capital, the world capitalist crisis affected Turkey in such a specific way. But after 1980s, especially after 1990s, the industrialization gained a specific, a different way. Not only world market, producing for world market, but also the bigger monopolies, the monopolies of the Turkish bourgeoisie began to aid actually internationalization of capital. They want to internationalize. In fact, for me, they, after 2000s, after the millennium, they began to transnationalize in one context. So, in this period, I think the workers' movements needs and requirements also changed. For example, the great black markets and black economy began to rise in Turkey. Black economy began to rise. Informal sector began to rise. And now, after 2001, the informal sector is now formal, because the labor acts are designed like that. Now all the workers, before working in a formal ways, are now working in such a informal conditions. They have no social security, they have precarious social security, the working conditions are precarious, part-time or other working. And this sector began to grow. I explain this because of that. That kind of proletarianization needs another acts, needs another actions, needs another organization. And in my opinion, in 1995, there was an event in Turkey, it was Gazi events, it was such an event that that kind of work is lost, or that kind of segments of the work is lost. It showed their representation. It was very aggressive. It was not in a collective gathering way, but party sometimes was widespread, maybe locally, beginning and sparking to other areas. So alphabet may be a memory, maybe historical memory, but will not be the same, of course, in this. But in my opinion, the occupation and self-management, of course, will survive again, need to, the workers will need to do that performance action, maybe, but in a new ways. And Turkey has gained a lot of space, steps for a lot of the privatization, for example, of nearly most of the public sector privatized. And this has affected the workers and composition of the workers.
No, I just wanted to comment. It seems to me that one of the common things that come out of that, themes that run through the talks, is this idea, this presentation that there are some alternatives to neoliberalism, and that people, and when something did happen, the workers in Turkey took over the factory industry, it was in the context of a social movement, of an alternative rising movement. And so, I mean, I would say that that is probably the major thing that the unions have to deal with and have dealt with in the past, when there was a rising union movement, when the CIO and was coming into being and brought about the New Deal, and they did, they are the ones who brought about the New Deal. It was done in the context that there was an alternative. Because, and I would say that people want an alternative. And that's why the capitalist press is working overtime to present Obama as a socialist. Because, that, you know, there's no alternative. So,
it's so funny that you talk about the no alternative, because because you're saying these, like, center-left parties are coming neoliberal now, and obviously Labour Party and the Democratic Party paint themselves as third way, like they're
I'm talking about on the ground level.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I'm a community organizer. Mm-hmm. People want an alternative, you know, on the ground level, and they don't see that in the Democrats or the Republicans. I mean, there were some of the young people who, you know, put forth this youth movement of thinking, you know, wow, well, you know, maybe there was change in Obama. They are very disillusioned.
I think that's the ironic thing about the third way, is like it's not really a third way, it's just a conservative, a neoliberal way, right? Yeah. It's so ironic in the naming of, like, you know, Democrats and New Labor. It's not New Labor, it's just acclimating to a neoliberal environment.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, when you know, like UE took over the factory outlet, that was supported. People, you know, people did not turn against that. The press was even forced to present that in a positive way because there was a lot of ground saw support for. You know, so maybe we need to start thinking about this quote old way of, you know, bottom up unionism that brings democracy back to the rank and file, and does start talking about an alternative, a real alternative solution.
Yeah,
no,
I didn't. Sorry, I didn't see your hand.
Sorry, no, I just had my really quick addition to that. I agree that it seems to me like people do want alternatives. And here with the Tea Party movement, and in Europe with the rise of the, I mean, you know, they're ridiculous, but also very scary. And so certainly in Europe with the, and here too, with the anti-immigration, rise of the anti-immigrant parties and more other kind of right-wing populist it seems to me like, well, because those are the only alternatives that people see. They're the only people who say, well, we've got to do something. We've got to support the, you know, the regular show. So there's, yeah. One would wish for a more palatable alternative.
In your analysis, too, you talked about Piven and Clower, both of you actually, have said, you know, because they basically say it's the moment of crisis. You know, the CIO itself, you know, the United Auto Workers weren't the ones who did the Flint sit down and was like, okay, workers did it themselves. And then the leaders had to get on their bicycles and catch up with the workers. It's that moment of crisis, they say, that gets management's attention or the politicians' attention. Once you defuse that moment of crisis and go to a hotel room, you know, and have, you know, a nice spread and the UAW meets with management, you're done, you're cooked. And so,
I would, at least in my case, I would say, and part of it, because this is just one aspect of my, as you probably know, or anybody else who knows about the winners, that there's several different strikes, but part of what I argue is that at least certain unions, for example, blaming the left wing union, newbie, which is actually two-thirds women, I argued that politicians, Labor Party politicians, and many trade union leaders lost their chance to actually look to this kind of new reform, because he was talking about E.T. Thompson, reformed kind of working class in this period of crisis, and actually heaped the blame on actually a union that eventually became very, very powerful and pivotal, still a very key union in Britain. It's reformed, but yeah, I think they just misused their chance, I guess, in that crisis.
Well, capitalism seems to go through a crisis about every 10 years or so.
It's getting more frequent, actually.
Yeah, exactly. It's shrinking every decade, but in every case it seems to be, well, you know, capitalism isn't working. You know what the answer is? More capitalism. So more concessions and so on. I think that the labor movement really has always been, I think, too conciliating towards capitalism, especially now when we have these concessions and the idea of what we need to be competitive. The CAW finds itself competing with other unions, which is it's really not the way to go. Obviously, there needs to be a lot more labor solidarity if you have any progress whatsoever. But even in the golden age during the post-war compromise, you still have the position where we accept that capital gets to control the things of production, capital gets to set prices and all that sort of stuff. It's not really an alternative. You're still attempting to extract what you can from the system that's inherently hostile, rather than replace the system itself. Yeah. But no one's really advocating any sort of change in the system, at the moment, at least less so what's happening on. And I agree with what you said, that there really needs to be a genuine alternative rather than just, you know, a different form of what we already have that obviously isn't working.
Okay, sorry. I think the self-organization and autonomy is an important agenda now. But not in the autonomous perspective, but maybe making it Marxist revision or class perspective revision or autonomous perspective. Autonomy and self-organization is very important in that case, in the age of maybe late capitalism or in the age of capitalism that financialized the social security, social health, public goods, that commodifies public goods. In such an age, capitalism financialized social security by Obama is something like it seems as if it is replaced by the collapse of AIG and some of the social security financial systems, but it is not replaced. I think in Europe they all take back the rights of social security of the workers. In Turkey they already have done that, and commodifying the public goods. So in the age of precarious work, quantifying public resources, sacred and social health, it's very important to think about self-organization and autonomy, but in a class perspective again, and not as Negri's supposition that the value is absolute, or value theory is also class, is mainly absolute class. I think just that's the time to think in class perspective, but reproducing class perspective in a, for that age, for the requirements of that age. And if we think for that you have to think directly, good is all the good, there's the good aspects and the bad aspects. The bad aspects of precarious work is all which we all see about aspects of precarious work, social, no social security, no social health, insecurity and other things, financial system, so after a crisis, your whole security is gone. And they said to you that that was a fund, and that fund derailed, so I can't do anything, your social security is not gone. But in that case, there is also the good side of precarious work, because I think in a political economic perspective, the working hours are already must be decreased to 6 hours, maybe 5 hours. In work perspective, because production is so acting like a thing. Can I explain, I think. And in precarious
mechanisms.
Yes, yeah. Technology mechanization. Yeah, yeah. Precarious work is maybe some kind of feature of not in that negative perspective that capitalism forces us. It's maybe a little less working hours and more social bonding.
We've got time for just one more.
Just about a question and comment to your presentation. When I try to follow the debate among new Keynesian political economy, I saw that they are, especially after the 1990s, they are suggesting national developmentalism, national protectionism are the solutions on the national level. And one of the problems of the labor movement in the world nowadays is that I just try to follow different cases, different country cases, and the problem is not about the unions. The problem is also about the objective dimensions of internationalization of capital movements bring reactions, and these reactions in, if you talk about political preferences or political mentality, the nationalists and protectionists demand our rights, and labor unions respond to these demands. So, maybe the solution is not, we should see the solution within the labor unions, because if you democratize labor union from bottom to up, it may not solve the problem. You should, I think, I don't want to give a magical solution to that question, but I think we should first think about the local alternatives, and we should also talk about the international alternatives. And internationalization of capital movements, I know, brings such nationalist protectionist demands and discourses. But also it brings new opportunities for in the solidarity of international labor movement or new solutions based on international level rather than nationalist or narrow level. So in the Canadian case, where I try to follow these debates, not only the labor unions, but also workers think in this way. They don't question the global division of labor or how the wealth is produced among the world and the differences, national economic differences between countries. The only thing they want to do to protect the status quo they had in time. And it was so strange for me when I went to Toronto, they were criticizing the United States as a foreign enemy, they are invading their country. Their international capital is distracting the national economy. So they it was so strange because, you know, Canada is not an underdeveloped or developed country. It's an advanced capitalist country. In Turkey, it is normal. You can understand. But in Canada, it was so strange. They were so nationalist in demand, in suggestions and solutions. Have you had a chance to talk with the workers in the
have a very brief response, but we're already running off time. People don't have to get anything else to say.
Very briefly, I think, yes, a lot of workers are thinking in nationalist terms, and it's even with these other countries thinking why our jobs and so forth, and not really thinking in global terms. And I think you're right, we need to think more in global labor movement. But until you change people's minds and attitudes, they, like you say, democratization is not even an achievement in a global perspective. Internalized neoliberalism. The same with a new party for the left. science on is not really achievement. I mean, people believe that life is no answers, just what we think it is. So, yeah, I think you have to all start thinking global terms. And maybe something that neoliberalism or neoliberals have really fostered is its idea of nationalism, because it is divide and conquer. If you can keep global working classes splintered and you prevent them uniting, and if you can pit Mexican workers against American workers and American workers against Canadian workers, that really weakens all of them. If they ever get together, capital's in trouble. So make sure we don't.
Well, that's cheerful.